tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Center Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. An examination of the actions and policies of the U.S. government in Latin America can shed light on the real goals of the Bush administration's so-called war on terrorism. As we'll hear on the program tonight, the war on terrorism is merely a new name for decades-old policies that have brought misery and murder to every country south of the U.S. border. Long before September 11, 2001, the U.S. government has been engaged in bringing to power and maintaining tyrannical regimes in Latin America. The justifications have evolved to match the rhetoric of the times: anti-communism, the war on drugs, and now the war on terrorism, or the ever-popular excuse, promotion of democracy. Tonight on the program, we'll contrast the rhetoric with the reality. But what is at issue in Latin America, as well as other parts of the world, including the Middle East, is the ability to control the natural and human resources of other nations in a manner that will be profitable to American multinational corporations and capitalists. Key among these resources is, of course, oil. In the first hour of the program, radio and print journalist and author Bill Weinberg will focus on what looks like America's new Vietnam, Colombia, as well as the fight of indigenous people in neighboring countries to protect their land and resources from being stolen by international monetary fund-supported privatization and development efforts. In the second hour, we'll hear what it feels like to be the grist for the imperial mill, from two Latin Americans, a small farmer in Colombia, and a famous Chilean man of letters. A producer at Radio WBAI-FM in New York City, a freelance print journalist, and the author of a recent book, Homage to Chiapas, The New Indigenous Struggles in Mexico. Since the September 11th attacks, he has been publishing an online newsletter called The World War III Report. He spoke last month at the Institute for Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont, as part of the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference.
I was in New York when it happened, and shortly after, September 11th, I've been working on a weekly newsletter, which been covering the global war on terrorism, initially looking at what was happening in Afghanistan, but we've since expanded as I've come to recognize that it really is a global conflict, and that all of the angles in terms of control of natural resources in terms of the Caspian oil, which are behind the military intervention in Afghanistan, are very much the same forces that are at play in wars which are going on in Latin America. And we've been calling it the World War III Report. Generally, it's just in cyberspace on the web. There's been some contention about the name, but we actually took it from a very conservative warmongering columnist for the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, came up with the name. He said that this is, September 14th of last year. He said that the United States has now entered World War III, and we have to realize we're at the beginning of what's going to be a very long war. So I don't think that we're merely being alarmist. Some people have also argued that, the Cold War was World War III, and really what we're in now is World War IV. And in fact, some commander Marcos of the Zapatistas referred to his own war as World War IV. That is to say, the war of indigenous peoples worldwide for control of their resources is World War IV. And I would argue that they are, in fact, the same war. That really what's sort of behind-the-scenes dynamic behind the so-called war on terrorism is really the war for corporate control of resources, and that the real enemy is increasingly indigenous peoples in the developing world. People are following the news from Colombia recently. It was just in the headlines. The extremely hard-line president-elect, now president, Alvaro Uribe, was just inaugurated last week, and he ran on a platform of escalating the war effort and really cracking down even further than they already have on the guerrillas, forming these civilian informer networks all over the country, which are very much a mirror image of Operation TIPS, which is in the news in this country. And of course, as he was inaugurated last week, the rebels attacked the Capitol, and there were huge explosions, and 14 people were killed in Bogota. Simultaneous with this, President Bush signed into law a provision of the new military aid to Colombia, another several million dollars on top of the $1.7 billion, which has already been passed, beginning with the so-called Plan Colombia Anti-Drug Initiative with President Clinton. But in this new package, which was just passed, now officially it's no longer an anti-drug effort, which was sort of the official fiction, but now it's actually a so-called anti-terrorist effort, or to use the old lingo, which is out of favor now due to the experience of Vietnam, a counterinsurgency effort. And whereas before, you know, officially the U.S. military aid can only go towards drug enforcement, but, you know, the guerrillas are in bed with the drug dealers, so we have to fight the guerrillas. But they were trying to maintain some kind of a distinction. They're not doing that anymore. Now they're acknowledging that it was a war against the so-called narco-terrorists of the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, or FARC, and a somewhat smaller group, the ELN, the National Liberation Army. And you can read all this in the papers, you can read all this in the New York Times. You'll also read, and this is still part of the official fiction, that another one of the groups which they're targeting is the AUK, the United Colombian Self-Defense Forces, which is the right-wing paramilitary network, which is also officially outlawed in Colombia and is also officially on the State Department terrorist list. However, contrary to what you might glean from the New York Times, in fact, none of this military aid is going to be used to target the AUK. In fact, the Colombian military is working hand in glove with the AUK against the leftist guerrillas, and I would argue against the indigenous population of Colombia. And this, in terms of the military's cooperation with the paramilitary networks, this is not just lefty conspiracy theorist Weinberg talking. You can get exactly that same analysis from Amnesty International or from Human Rights Watch, etc. And it's also obvious if you look at the geography of the conflict, which is why I brought maps. I'm sort of a map junkie. Let me see if I can rearrange a little bit so everybody can see it. Except something else which has hardly made the papers at all is that Plan Colombia, which has now been renamed the Andean Initiative because it's being expanded beyond Colombia also to Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, it was very much the same program of massive military aid and so on. But even when it was Plan Colombia, it called for the forcible relocation of around 20,000 peasants from this section of the Colombian Amazon in Putumayo, primarily in Putumayo province, along the Putumayo River, which is a tributary of the Amazon, which forms the border with Peru right here. And this is a zone of coca leaf production, and it's also a zone of sympathy for the FARC guerrillas, because basically the guerrillas exploit the coca production because under the U.S. mandated program, the coca is to be eradicated, including by the spraying of aerial herbicides all over the land. And it's the only means of support that the peasants have there, because all of the traditional crops which they've been growing have essentially been forced off the market, been priced off the market by the advent of free trade economics and all these cheap agribusiness exports from the United States for corn and so on, which are flooding into Latin America now into free trade economics. So the only means of support which the peasants have is coca leaf, the only way they can feed their families. So when the government comes in to eradicate the crops, it's a rather facile strategy for the guerrillas to come in and say, okay, we'll protect you from the government eradication forces if you protect our networks. And, you know, when we need people to fight, you give us your young men to fight for us and so on. So this is how this whole so-called nexus of narco-terrorism works. So they recognize that this is a community an area of support for the guerrillas. So Plan Colombia actually calls for the forcible relocation of some 20,000 peasants from this area into these redevelopment zones closer to the Colombian heartland in the Andes, where they'll be more under government control. A forcible relocation at gunpoint by these elite Colombian military units, which have been trained by the Green Berets. Now, when elite military units in Yugoslavia go into Kosovo and tell a bunch of Albanian peasants, okay, we're destroying your village, you can't live here anymore, we're forcibly relocating you. What do they call that? Anybody venture what the sort of official name in the media for that is? Ethnic cleansing, exactly.
Right.
Needless to say, it makes the headlines in this in the New York Times and so on, day after day after day, front page above the fold, and it's a part of, you know, with big sexy photos of dead peasants and their mothers and sisters in tears and so on, day after day after day after day. When it's being carried out by Colombian military forces, which are backed by our tax dollars, it doesn't make the New York Times at all. There was one story about this. It came out in official briefings, which the State Department provided to congressmen when they were trying to get Plan Colombia passed, and succeeded in getting Plan Colombia passed. And some of the congressmen released these briefing papers to the press. And you would think that there would have been a huge outcry about it, and it would have been on the front page of the New York Times. No. In fact, there was only one story about it, and this is now beginning. This plan is actually in operation now. There was only one story about it, and that was in the San Jose Mercury News. Not even the L.A. Times or the Washington Post, much less the New York Times. So-called newspaper of record. So, is it true that the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces are working with the drug dealers in a certain capacity? It's true, because the guerrillas are providing support for the peasants who are having to grow the stuff. So that's how they've been masking this as a counter drug campaign. Although now they're beginning to drop that fiction. In the north of Colombia, there's just as much coca being grown. And it's largely under the control of the AUC. It's largely under the control of the right-wing paramilitary network. And they don't actually, you know, provide support to the peasants who are growing the stuff. They're the ones who are actually buying the stuff from the peasants and are in bed with the people who are actually transforming the coca leaf into coca paste and into cocaine for export through the Caribbean and Central American isthmus to markets here in the United States. And in fact, a lot of people have argued that since the Cali cartel was crushed around 5 years ago, the real inheritor of the cocaine smuggling network and the new cartel, so to speak, is the AUC, the right-wing paramilitary network. And their base of support, as I say, is in northern Colombia. It's largely under their control, whereas the guerrillas control the Amazon basin region in southern Colombia. So, overwhelmingly, Plan Colombia and the so-called Andean Initiative military campaign, which has superseded it now, is targeting southern Colombia. And it's leaving the areas in northern Colombia, which are under the control of the AUC, completely untouched. But it's calling for the massive relocation of these peasant communities from southern Colombia, which they called in Vietnam draining the sea to if the guerrillas are fish swimming in the sea of the people, the idea is to drain the sea, which is what the U.S. did with the so-called strategic hamlets in Vietnam, and it's pretty much what the Serbian military did with the support base for the Albanian guerrillas in Kosovo. And it's again what the Colombian military is attempting to do now, is beginning to do now, under the minute direction of the Pentagon and the CIA in southern Colombia. And the campaigns which are taking place in northern Colombia, and again, this has all been documented by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on, the paramilitaries are working hand in glove with the actual military. The military will seal off regions where they feel that the guerrillas are beginning to gain a stronghold. They'll seal off all the roads into these remote villages and so on, throw up roadblocks. No traffic can get in or out. No journalist can get in or out to document what's going on until after the fact, after the paramilitaries have then gone into these villages and, essentially massacred everybody who they believe are collaborating with the guerrillas and, you know, tortured people in the village to get them to confess who the collaborators are and all that sort of thing. So it's a complete fiction that the military is in any sense going after the paramilitary networks. It's entirely centered towards the areas which are controlled by the guerrillas in the south of the country. And increasingly, the conflict is beginning to spill over the border, particularly into Ecuador, to a somewhat lesser extent into Peru as well. This whole region of Ecuador is becoming extremely militarized now. Both FARC, the Colombian guerrillas, as well as apparently U.S. Green Berets and so on, are starting to use the Ecuadorian rainforest as a sort of a rear guard for the war which is going on in Colombia. And as a result, you know, this whole region is becoming intensely militarized, and kidnapping, which is, you know, a major industry in Colombia, is, you know, there's a whole wave of it going on in the Ecuadorian rainforest as well now. So the conflict zone is spreading, and the U.S. is saying, well, in recognition that the conflict zone is spreading, we have to establish military bases now in Ecuador as well, in addition to the ones that they have in Colombia. And the U.S. is now, in fact, building a huge military base at Manta in Ecuador along the Pacific coast, just south of the Colombian border, and are expanding several airstrips in the Ecuadorian rainforest, immediately below the Colombian border as well. And in response to this, as well as in response to the attempted dollarization of the Ecuadorian economy 2 years ago, there was a nationwide civil Indian uprising, not an armed uprising, but a civilian revolt, where all of the government buildings were occupied and the roads were shut down and so on by the CONAI, which is the National Indigenous Alliance of Ecuador, which is also attempting to get the indigenous land demarcated in the Ecuadorian rainforest so that they will not be destroyed by the oil industry, which has targeted this whole area for a major phase of development. And in these national strikes which went on, in fact, the dollarization plan was temporarily defeated, at least, and the president of Ecuador was forced to step down. However, the U.S. military bases are going ahead, and the oil industry is going ahead, in fact, at a breakneck pace. They're now building already an oil pipeline which goes over the Andes from the rainforest oil fields to the Pacific coast. They're now building a second pipeline because they're planning on vastly expanding the oil exploitation there. And who the they in question are primarily at this point Occidental Petroleum, the same Occidental Petroleum which also has oil leases in northern Colombia, where they got into a very big and embarrassing mess, where indigenous people called the Uwa came forward and said that the lands which had been put aside for oil leases for Occidental Petroleum was actually their indigenous ancestral land. And the Colombian military, which is directly paid by Occidental Petroleum to guard their pipeline going over the Andes to the Caribbean coast, the Caño Limón pipeline, was also sent into the Ua country to break up the blockades. And now there's something very similar going on in Ecuador, where the Ecuadorian police, Ecuadorian national police and military are being sent in to break up these campaigns by campesinos and environmentalists blockading the construction of this second pipeline over the Andes. Now, under this new aid package, which was just passed, not only are they dropping the fiction that this is anti-drug enforcement and admitting openly that it's an anti-terrorism or counterinsurgency effort, but also now your tax dollars, Uncle Sam, is going to be picking up the tab for the policing of the oil pipelines from the guerrillas so that Occidental Petroleum no longer has to pay for it. In other words, U.S. tax dollars are going to be paying for it. Hasn't been in the headlines hardly at all, but there's a very similar situation in Bolivia right now. Major oil fields and gas fields are underdeveloped in the Chaparre region of the Bolivian rainforest, Bolivian Amazon, which is also the major coca-producing region of Bolivia. And who do you think has seized control in some very sleazy deals, which involve potential kickbacks to Bolivian officials, which is now under investigation by the Bolivian Congress? What U.S. corporation do you think just last year gained control over the pipeline networks, which are going to be delivering the oil and natural gas from the Chaparre region to international markets? A firm which is sort of a household name in this country for the past year, but not many people are aware of the Bolivian angle. Anybody begins with an E, ends with an N? Enron, very good. And Bolivia has not quite gone over the edge into war, but you've got a similar movement, similar to the one in Ecuador, where the indigenous peoples, in order to fight this pipeline plan, in order to fight the government, the U.S. mandated government imposed eradication of the coca crop. And most interestingly, they had a victory 2 years ago, just as in Ecuador they had a victory when they stopped the dollarization of the economy. In Bolivia, with a nationwide national strike, general strike, they succeeded in halting the privatization of Bolivia's water resources to the California-based Bechtel Corporation. And similarly, it's an indigenous-led movement. It's led by Aymara Indian peasants. It's a civil movement as opposed to a clandestine guerrilla movement such as you have in Colombia. And what's particularly interesting for us here at the Institute for Social Ecology is that there's a large segment of the movement in Bolivia which explicitly identifies itself as anarchist. However, one of the major leaders of the movement, a man by the name of Evo Morales, who is a veteran coca grower and an Aymara Indian, ran for president in the presidential elections which were just held in Bolivia. At the last minute, had his victory stolen from him. Essentially, there was a runoff where it seemed it was quite likely that he was going to win because the other two candidates were about equally divided. And the other two candidates two former presidents, the incumbent Gonzalo Sanchez, who cut these sleazy deals with Enron and Bechtel, and him and his arch rival, another former president, got together and cut a deal with each other where the other former president, the arch rival, decided that his people would support the incumbent and throw him his votes, and therefore Evo Morales was iced out of the presidency. So it seems like the potential for some so-called institutional reform, which might have taken place in Bolivia, has now been squeezed out. And at the same time, while the level of militarization in Bolivia certainly is nowhere near that of Colombia, which is one of the most dangerous places on earth right now, nonetheless, in response to the peasant resistance, there are these paramilitary groups which are actually being directly funded by the United States Embassy in Bolivia, again, ostensibly under cover of drug enforcement, which are being charged with a wide variety of human rights abuses against the peasants who have been blockading the roads and so on in Bolivia. And similarly, thus far, the movement in Bolivia, it's not explicitly a nonviolent movement, but largely in its tactics thus far, it's been a nonviolent movement. And, they've been blockading roads and that sort of thing. But now that, the situation is escalating, now that they've essentially had this movement has essentially lost its possibility of actually gaining power in Bolivia, and now that, they're facing this increasing militarization and these paramilitary groups and so on, if as soon as they up the ante and go from an unarmed movement actually picking up sticks or rocks or machetes or guns, you can bet that the fiction of anti-drug enforcement is going to go down in Bolivia just as it's already gone down in Colombia, and it's going to be integrated into this global war on terrorism. Similarly, we just saw the attempted coup d'etat in Venezuela, where Exxon and a bunch of other corporations were about to lose the fairly sweet deal which they've had in Venezuela under President Hugo Chavez was going to start demanding that more of their profit actually go into state enterprises for social redistribution programs. and so on. Probably a lot of you are aware of the so-called Puebla Panama plan, which the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, has sort of hitched his political future on. And of course, you know, Mexico is at the cutting edge of the free trade order. They're a full NAFTA partner. Bush just got fast-track legislation to expand NAFTA to South America, at which point it's going to become the FTAA, the free trade area of the Americas, as soon as they get the South American countries on board as well. But the whole question of getting all of these resources to market, which entails, you know, building all these new pipelines over the Andes, also is going to entail finding a replacement for the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal is practically a worthless ditch at this point. Not only is it too small to accommodate modern supertankers, but the Panama Canal is entirely based on, for its operations, on freshwater locks. In order to get over the mountain spine of the Central American Isthmus, they need all of this fresh water to fill the locks, actually raise the ships above sea level and get them over the mountains and back down to the other side. And all of this fresh water, of course, comes from the watersheds of the surrounding mountains, and now those watersheds are just about gone, largely due to deforestation of those mountains, which has to do with the inequitable land distribution patterns in Central America and so on. And the Indians are pushed from their traditional lands up into the mountains and into the forest, and they clear the forest and the trees go, and then the water goes, you know, and the soil goes. It all gets washed down off the mountains and in massive, you know, floods and mudslides, such as a particularly horrific one which we saw in Nicaragua a few years back, where an entire volcano collapsed and whole villages were wiped out. So basically the Panama Canal is obsolete, and they have to come up with a replacement for the Panama Canal, which is where the so-called Puebla Panama plan comes in. Vicente Fox, this is his brainchild, and it calls for building not just one new canal, but a whole series of new canals stretching all the way from Panama to the central Mexican state of Puebla. And actually, probably these aren't going to be literal canals, but they're going to be so-called dry canals, which are going to be major, you know, superhighways and freight, containerized shipping hubs with aligned with free trade hubs and harbor facilities and ports and so on either side, both the Caribbean and the Pacific side. But some of them actually call for real canals, where it's expedient. They're talking about building a new canal through Panama. They're talking about building a second canal through Nicaragua as well, because you've got this lake right in the middle, Lake Nicaragua, and you've got this the river feeding it, the San Juan River. So that would just have to be dredged and expanded, and then they just have to blast through this little narrow stretch of land right here, and they would have a new canal. And, of course, also the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. They're talking about building a so-called dry canal across as well. And then yet another plan, which would go through the state of Puebla, linking the Veracruz coast with Acapulco. Of course, you know, this is major super development projects, you know, and a major industrialization. It's going to massive land grabs from the peasantry. And, of course, now under the changes to the Mexican Constitution, which were pushed through in preparation for NAFTA, the you know, traditionally protected and so-called inalienable peasant lands in Mexico can now be sold off to the highest bidder or put up as collateral for bank loans or whatever. This is essentially going to exacerbate the same problem which led to the Panama Canal becoming obsolete in the first place, the peasants being pushed off of their lands and being pushed up into the mountains and into the forests and having to clear the lands and thereby destroying the lands and increasing their own situation, worsening their own situation of poverty, as well as worsening the whole situation of ecological decline in the region. And, of course, there's a great deal of resistance to this in Mexico. Probably we're all aware of the Zapatista movement, which is merely sort of the armed, you know, avant-garde or cutting edge of a much larger movement. Probably a lot of you saw the headlines from a place called Atenco recently, which is a little village immediately outside of Mexico City, where the government was going to come in and eminent domain all of the traditional peasant lands there to build a new airport for Mexico City. And the peasants there had an uprising, not with guns or anything, it was with their machetes. They took over the village, they threw up roadblocks, and they kicked out all of the all of the government bureaucrats and all the police, and eventually they did wind up taking hostages and succeeded. They got, after a showdown of several months, they succeeded in getting the airport plans canceled. So the government actually conceded. And this is, you know, just so there have been, you know, now in here in central Mexico, as well as in, as you know, the situation with Bechtel in Bolivia and the dollarization of the Ecuadorian economy, there have been victories along the way. And similarly, though, the situation in a little town called Tepoztlan, immediately south of Mexico City, around 5 years ago, very similar situation where the traditional lands of the Indians there were going to be grabbed to build a giant GTE computer center and golf course, which, and again, the Indians, you know, they took over the village government and they had a little uprising there, and ultimately the government blinked and they agreed to give them their land back. Vicente Fox, when he came to power, he ran on a platform. If he was, of course, you know, all this while, Chiapas has been in a state of sort of suspended between war and peace, where the negotiations were cut off between the Zapatista rebels and the government back in 1997, I believe, when the government, well, first refused to pass the original peace accord, which called for constitutional changes, recognizing the autonomy of indigenous peoples in Mexico. Fox ran on a platform of he was going to bring peace to Chiapas in 15 minutes, quote unquote. He was going to resolve the crisis in Chiapas. He was going to sign the accords and send them on to Congress to be ratified, and the situation would be resolved. Of course, what actually happened is that Fox's own party in Congress, the National Action Party, which is the party of corporate power, the Free Trade Party in Mexico, refused to sign the accords. And I think that Fox knew this, and he was playing a very cynical game. And essentially, they gutted the accords, and they made them non-binding. And all of these sort of squishy cultural rights. Yeah, you Indians are entitled to your little cultural ceremonies and so on. Sure. But everything which was binding and concerned control of land and territory and natural resources was gutted. So the Zapatistas said, no deal. These are not the accords which we signed. You know, and we're not going to lay down our arms. So the situation in Chiapas essentially hasn't changed. And Fox is in a very paradoxical position, because on one hand, he made this campaign pledge that he was going to bring peace to Chiapas in 15 minutes, which means giving the Indians throughout Mexico their autonomy with constitutional changes. On the other hand, you know, he's hitched his political future to the Puebla-Panama plan and expansion of the free trade system. And of course, if in fact there was, you know, binding control of local indigenous territories by the Indian peoples in Mexico, the Puebla-Panama plan would be in big trouble, because all of these, you know, big mega projects, these dry canals and so on, these trans-isthmus trade routes and so on, which are going to involve all these seizures of Indian lands, would be facing a very formidable obstacle. They'd be facing uncooperative traditional indigenous communities with actual juridical binding power over land use decisions in their own territory. So, in fact, the movement in Chiapas is spreading. The Zapatistas, the guerrillas themselves, have been very quiet lately. But the movement which they've inspired is spreading all over Mexico, in fact. Interestingly, the heartland of Mexican oil production, or really it began under the control of Standard Oil, today Exxon and Mobil, up here in Tampico, back around the turn of the century. And then in 1938, the oil was nationalized by President Lázaro Cárdenas, as most of you are probably aware. And then under the government's control, under the state oil company Pemex, they continued to expand down the Gulf Coast. And now the most heavily exploited area is in the state of Tabasco, immediately to the north of Chiapas. And back in the oil boom years of the 1970s, the next slated expansion, the next planned expansion of the oil industry was south from Tabasco into the Lac Andon Selva, the rainforest region of Chiapas, right up here against the Guatemalan border. And the reason it didn't immediately happen is because the peso crashed and oil prices crashed during the Pax Americana under in the Persian Gulf under Reagan. So That's why it never happened. Meanwhile, they never let go of these plans. They still continue to try to move the oil industry south into the Lock and Dome rainforest. After the oil shock following the Persian Gulf crisis in 1991, when oil prices started rising again, they started pursuing these plans much more aggressively, and Pemex started drilling test wells in the Lock and Dome Selvin. This was also at the same time that NAFTA was being negotiated, which called for privatizing state resources in Mexico as well as the communal holdings of the Indians. The one thing which they couldn't get away with privatizing, everything else has been privatized now in Mexico. The land is being privatized, you know, the airports are gone, the shipping routes are gone, the electrical grid is going, just about everything has been privatized in Mexico. The one thing which is remaining in state hands, because it's too much of a sort of a political sacred cow for them to touch, is Pemex, the oil industry. But they're beginning to get around to that already. In fact, the petrochemical division of Pemex is now open to investment, and Shell and Exxon and so on are starting to invest in it again. So and undoubtedly, you know, the plans under Fox, particularly for this next phase of exploitation of the Lock and Dome Selva, not necessarily to be under the hands of Pemex, but to be once again under the hands of Exxon and Standard Oil and Mobil, from whom, you know, under the name of Standard Oil before the, you know, antitrust action, or initially controlled Mexican oil. Of course, the second intervening crisis that prevented this expansion into the Lock and Dome Selva was, of course, in 1994, the Zapatista uprising took place, and the Zapatistas, you know, their heartland is in this rainforest region in the Lock and Dome Selva, and they essentially seized control of it during the uprising, and it remains to a large extent, although there's been some increasing government control in the region, government incursions into the region. But to a large extent, it still remains an autonomous zone or liberated territory within Mexico. And, of course, when that happened back in 1994, Pemex got the hell out of there really fast. This remains a formidable obstacle to these so-called free trade plans. One of the reasons that, you know, the war on terrorism, so-called, has not been aggressively extended to Mexico the way it has to Colombia is because the Zapatistas are extremely politic, and they play their cards very, very well, and they have really maintained the perception of the moral high ground within political debate in Mexico and internationally as well. In vivid contrast to the FARC in Colombia, who have essentially behaved like a bunch of cutthroat thugs, and it's been very easy to demonize them as such when they actually behave that way. Nonetheless, the U.S. administration is very aggressive of pushing the war on terrorism to the Western Hemisphere. It's very touchy with Mexico because of the whole, you know, history of the Mexican-American War in 1848, and the fact that they're right on the U.S. border. The government there is much more touchy about being perceived, being a Yankee puppet than many other countries in Latin America. There's a lot of factors which have been slowing this whole process in Mexico. Nonetheless, it's definitely at work in Mexico. And the week after the September 11th attacks, if you watch the news from Latin America, a lot of very interesting things happen. One of which is that during September 11th, Colin Powell was actually in Colombia meeting with then President Pastrana, discussing precisely this transition from an anti-narcotics footing to an anti-terrorist footing. Another very interesting development was that the Mexican Attorney General and National Security Advisor released this spate of press releases about Islamic extremists active in Mexico. And this is also something which we've heard again and again since 9/11. That the Palestinians and Hezbollah and the IRA are working with the Colombian guerrillas. And now you're beginning to hear the same thing in Mexico, that Palestinians and Hezbollah and ETA, the Basque separatists from Spain, are cooperating with, not with the ECLN, but with these other sort of more murky, smaller guerrilla groups which are active in the mountains in Guerrero and Oaxaca, like the EPR, the Ejército Popular Revolucionario, which seems to be much, much more mysterious and clandestine and sort of doctrinaire Marxist-Leninist than the Zapatistas, but doesn't seem to have as much of a popular support base as the Zapatistas. Colombia, within the Western Hemisphere, is where this model is most advanced. But there's big potential for this model to be exported south into Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia. And incidentally, in Peru, they just had another victory where in Arequipa province, they were going to privatize the electrical grid. I can't recall for what company at the moment, but the peasants there and the workers similarly had a coordinated regional general strike throughout Arequipa province and succeeded in getting those plans ditched. So there's big potential for this model of this sort of anti-terrorism paradigm, which is actually masking a crackdown on indigenous movements to protect their resources and corporate control, much as the war on communism did back in the Cold War, much as the war on drugs did just a year ago. Big potential for this model to be expanded south into down the Andes, all the way down to Bolivia, as well as north up the Central American Isthmus, all the way to Mexico. Now, why don't I talk just briefly about what's going on in Central Asia and the Persian Gulf. And in terms of the hidden agendas for control of resources likely behind the war effort, which is not to say that, Al-Qaeda doesn't exist and didn't blow up the World Trade Center, but, wars have always got political context, regardless of the, immediate ostensible enemy. The corporations which want to exploit these resources are extremely ruthless and will stop at nothing. But really, what it's about is profits. It's about money. It's about people getting rich. And what the struggle for the Caspian Basin's oil is also about profit. It's also about making money. It's also about people getting rich. But it's not only about that. It's also fundamentally about who is going to control the world. Zbigniew Ziobryński, who is the leading intellectual light behind the Trilateral Commission, and was National Security Advisor under Carter, is a big theorist over the new great game in Central Asia. And one of his favorite sayings is the global primacy is the prize and Eurasia is the playing field. And the reason that Latin America is less relevant is because everybody in the world accepts that it's the U.S. backyard. And there aren't any rival powers who are challenging us. The only people who are challenging U.S. hegemony in Latin America are the Latin American peoples themselves. There isn't any, rival superpower. Whereas, Eurasia has always been particularly Central Asia, has always been the playing field, going all the way back to the great game of the last century between Russia and Great Britain. With Russia, moving into sort of greater Turkestan, which includes Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, etc., from the north, and the Brits moving in from the south, from the Indian subcontinent, with Afghanistan and Iran and so on being the pawns in the struggle, where the wars were actually fought. What's happened since the Second World War is that the U.S. has stepped into the shoes of British imperialism. And during the final years of the Soviet Union, their big push was to, or they'd already, ever since the 1920s, been exploiting oil on this side of the Caspian Basin, on the Caucasian side, primarily in Azerbaijan. And in fact, it was these oil fields which were the gold for Operation Barbarossa, for Hitler's disastrous invasion of the Soviet Union, was to get his hands on that oil, which was the only way that he had any possibility of maintaining control of Europe, because the Allies had a limitless supply of oil from Latin America, primarily from Venezuela and from Mexico. So it was Hitler's reckless gamble to get hold of that oil. There was plenty of more oil, which they never got around to exploiting, on the other side of the Caspian Basin. The big plan in the 1980s was for the Soviets to begin exploiting that oil, at the same time that they made their own hubristic mistake of invading Afghanistan and got their asses handed to them in Afghanistan and sort of created a self-fulfilling prophecy where the Islamic movements which they were fighting in Afghanistan being vigorously backed by the CIA. And once again, here is sort of the opposite. While the CIA's not-so-secret war in Nicaragua during that same period was making headlines, day after day after day in the 1980s, much, much, much more money from the CIA was going into the war in Afghanistan, a much, much bigger war. But you heard a lot less about it. And eventually, these Islamic guerrillas started launching operations to the north, into Uzbekistan, into Tajikistan, into actual Soviet territory. And there was the hemorrhage of Soviet resources into the war effort in Afghanistan, which helped push the Soviet Union over the edge into collapse. And immediately after they do so, U.S. oil companies jump into these newly liberated post-Soviet territories and start cutting deals for exploitation of this very oil, which the Soviet Union wanted to exploit on the eastern side of the Caspian Sea. And particularly the two countries which have got all this great Caspian seaside real estate, with all, where they can do all those offshore rigs, are Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. The deal in Kazakhstan was cut with Chevron. And one of the people who was instrumental in setting up the deal, brokering the deal between the government of Kazakhstan and Chevron, was a particular Halliburton executive who was then sitting on the Kazakhstan National Oil Board, who went on to become Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. Similarly, the government of Turkmenistan hired a former U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor and intellectual leading light of the Council on Foreign Relations, who now happens to be wanted for questioning in connection with war crimes in Chile and France, by the name of Henry Kissinger. And he was the one who brokered the deal between Turkmenistan and UNICAL. And UNICAL immediately begins negotiating with the what was then the Taliban regime in Afghanistan to build a pipeline from the oil fields in Turkmenistan across Afghanistan to Karachi, Pakistan's port on the Arabian Sea. And this was at the same time that the official line of the United States was for the Taliban to be completely isolated. And the Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was complaining to the UN about how they were oppressing women and all this sort of thing, which of course, you know, they were. And but at the same time, her own State Department was very quietly giving visas to top Taliban leaders to come to the United States to meet with U.S. officials and to meet with UNICAL officials in their offices in Sugarloaf, Texas. And they actually did sign some kind of memorandum of understanding about UNICAL getting the pipeline routes across Afghanistan. Finally, all of this falls apart when the wars in Afghanistan continue, and quite decisively, of course, falls apart on September 11th of last year, when all of a sudden the Taliban were being vigorously demonized, and it was clear that we were going to go to war in Afghanistan. And we have been ever since. There's been a lot of talk, which we've, in our newsletter, we've been trying to nail down. It seems like it's fairly likely that the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who was essentially became president in a process that was greased by the United States at the summit of Afghan leaders and international donors, which took place in Bonn, Germany last year. It was a former consultant who was hired by UNICAL before the Taliban under the previous government. UNICAL has been insisting that they don't have any plans to build this pipeline anymore, and that the situation in Afghanistan remains entirely too unstable, and that it's not a very good investment for them, and they're looking elsewhere, such as Burma, where they're actually, again, it's been getting practically no press in this country whatsoever, but UNICAL is building a pipeline in Burma. The Burmese regime, the so-called SLORC regime, the military dictatorship in Burma, has very compliantly been supplying slave labor. Villagers who have been rounded up at gunpoint in the Burmese ethnic cleansing campaigns to help build this pipeline and to clear the rainforest. An absolute horror show. You don't hear anything about it in this country. But the UNICAL's official line remains that we're not going to go into Afghanistan, too unstable. And they're just sort of folding their arms and are waiting for Uncle Sam with our tax dollars to provide a modicum of stability. just as Uncle Sam with our tax dollars is providing, attempting to provide a modicum of stability in Colombia for Occidental Petroleum. And meanwhile, the Russians, who are desperately trying to reassert control of what they consider to be their backyard and their turf, and which was in fact under Moscow's control just 10 years ago, they just recently signed a deal for pipeline routes across Afghanistan. And additionally, they, at the same time, this is just in the last couple of weeks, at the same time that they signed this deal with the new Afghan interim government for pipeline routes across Afghanistan, they are also doing military maneuvers in the Caspian Sea itself. And the Afghan government is a very uneasy coalition between forces which are more loyal to the U.S., such as Hamid Karzai, and the forces of the former Northern Alliance, the Uzbek and Tajik militias in the north who had been resisting the Taliban back when the CIA was backing the Taliban via their surrogate Pakistan back in the 1990s, which are, and traditionally these northern militias have been traditionally, you know, they've been backed by Russia. And now the regime in Afghanistan is sort of an uneasy alliance between these mostly Pashtun elements who are closer to the U.S. and Pakistan, and these mostly Uzbek and Tajik elements, which are closer to Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Russia. The big potential for the regime in Afghanistan to fall apart and for a full-scale civil war to reemerge there, with, again, all of these intrigues over who's going to control this oil lurking in the background. And this is not only about UNICAL making a buck. This is about so-called global primacy and making sure that the Caspian Basin is, in fact, colonized by Chevron and UNICAL, and ultimately by NATO, at the same time that the Russian army is trying to woo Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan back into their sphere of influence and is doing these joint military maneuvers with them in the Caspian. At the same time, NATO is trying to woo them into their sphere of influence. They've already established these partnerships for peace links between NATO and Kazakhstan. Partnership for Peace being a sort of the ante room before you get to be a full member of NATO. You have to join Partnership for Peace. And there are actually NATO advisors in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and so on. In fact, a huge U.S. military presence in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan now as well. So again, this has to do not merely with UNICAL making a buff, but who's going to control the Caspian Basin, making sure that it is forces which are loyal to the West, and not forces which are loyal to the Soviet, or the former Soviet Union, to Russia, so as to prevent the Russians from being able to get their hands on this oil wealth, so as to be able to rebuild their empire and threaten the West. And once again, you know, it's the indigenous peoples, the local peoples, who are going to get their land stolen from them and are going to be ethnically cleansed by the warring factions in the region. I'm enthused about what's going on in Latin America, because there are actually indigenous resistance movements there which have got their eye on the ball politically and are worthy of our support. It's a lot harder to find elements in this part of the world which are worthy of our support, but they do exist, such as RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, which have vigorously opposed all of the warring fundamentalist factions, as well as the Soviet occupation back in the 1980s. In Afghanistan, and really do seem to support, secular democracy and so on.
I'm not really convinced. It's a very convincing story you tell. But I'm wondering, are there any other stories going on? I mean, your story is basically one about oil. I mean, earlier today we had a session here where someone was talking about the way in which the finances is being deregulated to provide new opportunities for capitalism to make money. Or last week I was at another conference and was talking about the deregulation of the telecommunications industry, again to provide more opportunities for capitalism to make money. I mean, are there other strategic stories going on in the world besides oil? Because you've told a story that's all about oil.
There's other things going on in the world apart from oil. Somehow it all works together. I mean, it's not just about oil, it's about Islamic fundamentalism, and it's about terrorism, and it's about lots of things, but somehow it all works together, because, you know, the whole human system, as we all know, is a big interactive organic whole. So, you know, saying that it's about any one thing is misleading. That said, the global economy runs on oil, you know? It doesn't run on, there's been plenty of covert CIA actions in Central America over the decades that had to do with bananas. But the world economy doesn't run on bananas. The world economy runs on oil. And, you know, the big money is to be made on oil. And, you know, empires are made and broken on oil. And the whole, you know, downward spiral of ecological collapse is being fueled by the oil economy as well. And this also has to do with, you know, the distortion of science by the government and by corporate power, because they don't want to admit that climate destabilization is happening. The story which we're telling is primarily about oil. Yes, I'm not saying that it's the only story by any means. But I would say that in some sense it's sort of the paradigmatic or hegemonic or whatever big fancy word you want to use. It's the big story in some way.
The next person to ask a question wanted to know how current U.S. military involvement in Colombia compares to early U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
Well, it is already America's next Vietnam up to, say, 1964. Is there going to be a Gulf of Tonkin incident, and they're going to send in massive numbers of U.S. troops? There's already U.S. troops fighting there. I mean, they'll deny it, but, you know, they'll just call them advisors. It came out, practically 20 years after the fact that, in fact, you know, these so-called advisors who had an officially non-combatant role in Nicaragua and in El Salvador in the 1980s, they were actually fighting. It came out 20 years after the fact, but it finally did come out. And I'm quite sure that they're fighting now in Colombia. Are they going to actually, you know, start drafting American kids and sending them down to the rainforest of Colombia? They want to avoid that because it got them into a whole big mess in Vietnam. And if they can use brown-skinned people to fight brown-skinned people in the third world where life is cheap, they'd much rather do that. So I think that they would like to avoid it becoming the next Vietnam in terms of, you know, quagmires. Yeah. But it's already the next Vietnam in terms of a U.S.-directed counterinsurgency war. And whether there's going to be a Gulf of Tonkin and we're going, it's actually they're going to start drafting kids, I sure hope not. But I don't dismiss the possibility completely. But they hope not, too. You know, they meaning the administration and, you know, Congress and so on, they hope not, too. They don't want to see that happen.
In terms of more substantial U.S. military presence, troops.
Well, how much more substantial do you want? I mean, sure, it's already, like I say, it's 1964. You know, if it gets any more substantial, it's going to be Vietnam.
Can you quantify that? There's 20,000 advisors, there's 2,000 advisors.
I'm bad with numbers. I think officially it's less than that. I think officially it's like a few hundred advisors. But that's, correct me if I'm wrong, any historians here? I think that's about the level that was at in Southeast Asia in 1964, before the Gulf of Tonkin. And, of course, many more Colombian troops are being brought up to the United States to be trained at at Fort Bragg and Fort Benning and so on. And you've got the massive military aid, you know, the hundreds of helicopter gunships and so on. And instead of Agent Orange, it's glyphosate. You know, they're spraying, the U.S. is actually contracting the pilots, former Green Beret and DEA and so on pilots to actually fly the helicopters that are spraying this all over the rainforest down there. And of course, you know, once again, even though there's plenty of coca which is being grown in the in northern Colombia, overwhelmingly the spraying is going on in southern Colombia, where the guerrillas are. It has to do with, again, with draining the sea and making the zones of guerrilla control, uninhabitable, basically.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.